Those of you who are visiting with us, we are especially glad that you could be here. Those of you who are back from the European campaigns, we're glad that you are here. We've missed you. We know that many of you are back and have already seen you. We're thankful for your presence today and that you're back with us in the work. For those of you who were here for the adult class in the auditorium, I know that you've already been blessed by having been in the assembly today. Brother Joe Pryor taught a class that I felt like was so very to the point. If you missed it, you missed something that was greatly edifying. I was jarred by it and shaken by it. And I'm thankful for him as one of our elders who has this ability to teach. Having just celebrated our 198th national birthday, I think it today very a fortunate coincidence that we've been studying recently on the subject of morality. And I think it appropriate today to continue that study as we examine some of the things that exalt a nation and some of the things that debase a nation and disgrace a nation. Proverbs 14:34 says that sin is a reproach to any people. It's righteousness that exalts the nation. President Adams was quoted on television last week as having stated that the July the 4th celebration should be celebrated before God with reverence. And I thought when the statement was made, we've come a long way, baby, in 198 years. God in America has virtually been dethroned. And there remain today very few absolutes when it comes to morality. And we noticed last Sunday that morality or righteousness actually is based upon two fundamental pillars. Those two fundamental pillars are these: an awareness of God and an acceptance of a tangible code of ethics. You deny either one of these two, and you virtually deny both of them. And the result being that we enter into a moral depression and a deterioration that amounts to national disgrace. You deny the existence of God, and you're not going to have very much respect for your fellow man. Ignore the existence of God, and you're not going to have a very great impelling force for doing what's right. On the other hand, deny the existence of a tangible code of ethics, and in essence, you really and truly deny the God who is the author of those ethics. You deny the existence of the God whose character is those ethics. And so you deny either one of these, either deny the existence of God, or just simply live in a way that you're unaware of him, or deny the existence of a tangible code of ethics, and I'm convinced that you're well on the way to a debauched, debased, and disgraced way of living. In the book of Romans, Paul identifies both of these as being the pillars upon which true righteousness exists. In verse 21 of chapter 1, he says that though they knew God, they did not honor him as God. But they became vain in their thinking, and their senseless heart was darkened. In verse 32, he says, though they know God's decree, that those who live like this are worthy of death, they not only practice them, but they encourage others to engage in them also. That's a paraphrase. The Apostle Paul also states in the first chapter of Romans, again in verse 18, that all people who live in such a manner as he describes here, denying the existence of God, refusing to have him in their knowledge, and though they know his decree, denying his decree and living in contrast to what he says is right, Paul says that the wrath of God will come forth from heaven upon all who engage in such living as that. That the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness and ungodliness, and that that wrath is revealed upon all who engage in that kind of living. And may I say this morning that America will not be any exception to that rule. The Gentile nations that flew in the face of God and destroyed the system of morality that he had established, those Gentile nations rotted from within. The Jewish nation, who should have had every reason for being an example of morality and of a superlative kind of life, they rotted from within because they turned their back upon the same God and upon the same code of ethics that the Gentiles had turned their back upon. And we'll not be any exception today in America. Last week we noticed the first of these two fundamentals, the first of these two basic principles, that of the awareness of God, and noticed how that in turning their back upon the awareness of God, that nations went astray and finally resulted in the debased morality that we noticed in the world today. Today, I want us to look briefly at the second of these two causes and see how that though the world knew the decree of God concerning moral principles, that the world turned their back upon this that was, I think, well known. And they, in that deliberate denial of that which was right, they continued this spiral of death that Adam and Eve had started in the garden when they also, being unaware of God and unwilling to take him into their consideration, turned their back upon God's legislation to them, simple though it was, just simply this, don't eat the tree. But when they simply said, we're going to eat it regardless, they in essence did the very thing that people from that time until this have done, ignoring God or refusing to take him into consideration and destroying whatever tangible code of ethics has been delivered to us by God. And so today the world continues this spiral of death, and they do it intentionally to their own destruction. May I say, simply by the way of introduction, the similarity between the law of Moses and the codes of other nations that predate the law of Moses and predate the nation of Israel drives me, and I hope to convince you and drive you to the conclusion, that there existed before the law of Moses law by which people were able to direct and guide their lives. The similarity between the law of Moses and the laws of the nations around about is a striking similarity in many respects. Now understand this, that there are many things about the law of Moses that are not very similar to the laws around about them. In fact, there are many things in the Ten Commandment law that are so unique that it sets the Ten Commandment law and the entire legislation of Moses and the entire nation of Israel apart as a very unique people on earth. For example, the commandments number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 10 are five commandments of the Ten Commandments that are directly or that are specifically unique in the legislation of Moses. The first three of these commandments, we noticed last week, had to do with the existence of God. So much so that we find that the Ten Commandment law rather than being just simply a law about a law, is really a revelation about a God. And this is something that no other nation in the history of the world has ever experienced. No nation has ever given a set of laws or a code of ethics that was introduced by the revelation of a God of moral character, of a God of superlative worth and value. No other nation has ever had that. That makes them unique. The second, or the fourth commandment, the second in these considerations, the fourth commandment was the commandment regarding the Sabbath day. It also is a peculiar commandment. No other nation, as far as I know, has ever been given the commandment to remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. The Sabbath commandment was given to the Israelite nation out of respect for their peculiar origin. And in Deuteronomy, the fifth chapter, in verse 15, there God says, this is why I've commanded you to keep the Sabbath day, out of remembrance of the fact that I delivered you out of Egypt, out of your slavery. It was based back in the creation of God when God rested from his labor. And that's found in Exodus, the 20th chapter. But in the Deuteronomy, in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 5 and verse 15, these two things are brought together. And God said, you're a peculiar people, and I've given you this commandment to keep because of the fact that you were delivered out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then the 10th commandment is another peculiar commandment. As far as I know, there's no other legislation that parallels it in the history of any nation. And that is the commandment to not covet. Thou shalt not covet. This particular commandment gets down into the heart and attempts to regulate the thinking and the motives of people, not just their actions. So this, in a way, I say these things about the law of Moses, set that group of people and set that law apart in a very peculiar way. These 10 commandments, 5 of them, said here is the revelation of a peculiar God, here is the revelation of a peculiar origin of people, and here is the revelation of a peculiar legislation or a peculiar code of ethics. It has to do with your heart as well as with your actions. Now, those are the things about the law of Moses that are not similar to other laws. But there are some similarities that I want to point you to this morning that are interesting, I think. The 5th through the 9th commandments, commandments 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, are the other 5 that regulate murder, adultery, theft, false witness, and the honoring of parents. These 5 commandments can all be verified and documented and found in legislation that predates the Mosaic legislation by at least 500 years. Now we have exact concrete evidence that these commandments can all be documented in other legislation of other nations at least 500 years predating that of the law of Moses. Not only that, but when you take into consideration the nations and the peoples who were a part of the biblical revelation that predated the law of Moses by at least 2,500 years, you find a very startling revelation. And I mean by that, those histories of the nations and peoples that predate the law of Moses that are the biblical record are found simply and exclusively in the book of Genesis. That's a 2,500 year, approximately, a 2,500 year history of people who lived prior to the giving of the law of Moses from Mount Sinai. And yet all 5 of these principles, that of honoring mother and father, that of a forbidding of murder, adultery, theft, and false witness, these 5 commandments, these 5 moral principles, can be found all the way through the book of Genesis, and they are well established in the lives of the people that are recorded in that book. Well, you say, well, what on earth, what does that make? What difference does it make? All right, you hang on a minute and I'll tell you, but don't let me lose you. That's the biblical evidence that predates the law of Moses. But there is extra-biblical, and I mean by that outside the biblical record. There are other nations that have had these principles of morality as a part of their ethics, and these nations predate the law of Moses by some 500 years. The one that I'm particularly referring to is the Code of Hammurabi, which has been discovered and has been translated Hammurabi lived about 1900 B.C. He's considered by many Bible scholars to be the same man as is mentioned in Genesis, the 14th chapter, in verse 1, whose name was Amraphel, who was a contemporary of Abraham, who was one of the great kings of the Mesopotamian Valley. And he lived at the time that Abraham and these great patriarchs lived. In fact, if you'll notice the book of Genesis, the morality of the book of Genesis has its base in the code of ethics of Hammurabi. If you want to see a commentary on the code of Hammurabi, look at the morality of the life of Abraham and those people who came from him. They reflect this Mesopotamian morality. Well, let me give you some examples of it. When it comes right down to the specific commandments, notice if you will. But first of all, let me say this. We are driven to the conclusion when it comes to these five principles of morality, that of honoring your mother and daddy, that of against adultery, against murder, against false witness, and against theft. When we see that these principles existed at least 500 years earlier than the law of Moses, we're driven to the conclusion that when God made known these things to the Jews, it was not the revelation of something brand spanking new at all, but it was simply a divine reminder to his peculiar people that this is what's right and I'm expecting you to live by it. But it was a reminder to these peculiar people of something that was not new. It was a reminder of something to them that had been known by the world in general pretty well from the time that the world existed or the people existed. For example, murder, though it is not, as far as I could find, prohibited in words in the code of Hammurabi, and I looked for it over and over and I couldn't find it. And then it dawned on me that this thing of taking life from someone else was so well understood as being prohibited that it is not even stated verbally as having been forbidden. But it lies as the very basis of the whole legislation through Hammurabi, the king of Mesopotamia. It's forbidden and serves as the very basis of the code of Hammurabi. Adultery is forbidden in statute number 129 of the code. Theft is forbidden in statutes 6, 8, 9, and 10 of that code. False witness is forbidden in statute number 3, number 4, and number 11. And honoring of parents is forbidden in statute number 195. Now that takes care of the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th commandments of the 10 commandments. They're all documented, they're all stated in very clear language and very fully in this code of Hammurabi. I find that interesting, and I think it drives us to a conclusion that will help us in our approach to morality today. Notice something else. In their supplementary laws, there was very much similarity between the law of Moses and this code of Hammurabi. For example, their law of retribution was this: eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Now that sounds Bible, doesn't it? Well, it is Bible. It was the law of Moses, expression of the law of retribution, the law of liability. Those of you men who are building houses, if a man built a house, a contractor, Hammurabi said, if he built a house for somebody and it was so poorly constructed that the wall fell down and killed the man that bought the house, the contractor was to be put to death. That ought to give you something to think about. There are a lot of other things that would startle you as far as liability is concerned and the laws of retribution. Property rights, divorce and remarriage, liability laws, natural disaster benefits. If a terrible rain came down and terrible weather had destroyed a man's crop and he had borrowed the seed to plant the crop, he was not to pay interest on that seed the first year. He was to be given another year in order to make the payment. Things like this, you see, and they're all through this code of Hammurabi, very detailed, very explicit. All right, now I want to ask you a question. Where did these concepts come from? I'm interested primarily in the ones that have to do with morality, murder, adultery, false witness, theft, and the honor of parents. Where did they get these principles, these concepts? Obviously, for the Jew, these things were revealed to them by God. In Romans 3 and 1, it says that the advantage that the Jew had was that they were the possessors of the oracles of God. The oracles of God had been committed to them. In Hebrews 1 and 1, it says that in the times past, that God revealed himself to our fathers by the prophets in divers portions and in divers manners. God gave these Hebrew people this special insight, and it gave them a special advantage over the Hebrew, over the Gentile people. But where did the Gentiles get their concepts? We noticed last week that they were aware of God. They didn't know about him in detail like the Jew did, but they were aware of him. We're noticing today that they were aware of, and very explicitly aware of, very clearly aware of this thing of the moral standard. They knew what was right. You weren't pulling something new on a Gentile when you were to tell him that he shouldn't be stealing. He knew that. You weren't telling him something new when you were to tell him that he wasn't supposed to commit adultery. They knew that. That he was supposed to honor his father and mother. He knew that. Well, where did they get these concepts? Well, I believe that these concepts came from the very fact that they were people. Paul simply says that they knew these decrees of God, that they weren't supposed to act in certain ways. I believe what he's saying there in the first chapter of Romans and in the second chapter of Romans when it says, when the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature or naturally what is written on the law, they become a law to themselves. He says here these people were regulating their lives in a way that was natural, in harmony with the law of Moses. And I'm thinking that simply that it means that these people had within them, because of the fact that they were human beings, they had within them these moral principles that told them this is either right or it's wrong. And you're not to have anything to do with it if it's wrong, or you're to do it if it's right. And these fifth through the ninth commandments drive us to that conclusion. For the Jew, it was a matter of revelation. For the Gentiles, I think it was a matter simply of being a human being. That as a human being made in God's image, human beings are able to assess information. They are able to come to conclusions. They are able to come to practices that were recognized universally as, you know, being just right. Now you may think, well, I don't know how you can prove that. Well, I don't know whether I can or not. But when Paul says that they do by nature the things that are written in the law, that they become a law to themselves, it drives me to that conclusion. When Paul says that these people knew God's decree, and yet they turned their back upon it anyway, it drives me to the conclusion that, well, by the way, it must have been because of the fact that they were human beings. Perhaps it had something to do with the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil that Adam and Eve ate. I don't know. Maybe that's where the knowledge was imparted. I don't know. But I do know that when Cain killed his brother Abel, he didn't come up to his mother and dad and say, look what I did. He took him and hid him in the sand. Well, there wasn't any law that said he shouldn't kill his brother. No, but because he was a human being, he knew better than to kill Abel. He knew when he killed him that he was doing wrong. Well, there was no legislation that we have in the record of prior to that about the killing of a human being. Later there was, but not prior to the death of Abel. No. I think these people got these principles because of the fact that they were human beings. Let me give you some illustrations now how in other areas we concur with what God has said and what he's done. In the realm of nature, the universe, man recognizes God in the realm of in the universe in the book of Romans chapter 1:19, the statement where it says, though they knew God, they didn't honor him as God. That's an affirmation of it. An illustration of how they knew this God, or that they did know him, is found among the Greek people who preceded the coming of Christ by hundreds of years. These people had come to a conclusion that the universe in all of its greatness was the result of the logos of God, or the mind of God, or the word, or the personality of God. They had come to that conclusion, that there's no other conclusion that we can draw, but that the regularity of the seasons, that the symmetry and the design and the beauty of the universe must be the result of the mind of this great eternal God. That's about all they knew about him, but they did know that. Nature drove these people to the conclusion that there was a God. Well, you know, in the realm of nature today in the universe, engineers today among our own very advanced civilization, men who are structural engineers today, will tell you that as far as the structural design by which you can get the maximum volume at the least strain and greatest strength of construction, they say that there is not a design that excels the design of the simple honeycomb of the bee. And they've figured this thing out in a sense that they've come down to the very angle of the sides, this hexagonal. And they say, that's it. If you want to know what is the maximum structural strength for the maximum volume, it's the honeycomb. And watch this little fellow fly in there and build that thing, and then tell me how he built it. How did he know that that was the best way to design it? And engineers sit there with their mouth open. An engineer may not be able to explain it, but he sits there and concurs with it and says, you know, that's right. By the way, that's right. In the principles of aerodynamics, do you know how we've made the big C-5 fly? Do you know how the Wright brothers made their Kitty Hawk fly? They took the principles of aerodynamics that they saw in nature, that they observed in the very simple flight of a bird. They constructed their wings like the wings of a bird, and they flew. I saw an illustration the other day, a cartoon, where some little birds were sitting in a nest, two little baby birds were talking to each other, and they saw an airplane go by, and they said, nah, if God wanted us to fly, he'd have given us propellers. No, we know what aerodynamics is or are, what the principle is, and we construct our planes to conform to that law that God himself has created. Something else. Aesthetically, there is something within you because of the fact that you're a human being that says, oh, look at that rose. Look at that rose. I don't care whether you're an atheist or a firm believer in Jesus Christ. There's not a man or a woman or a child that can look at a rose without something down inside him saying, pitter-pat, pitter-pat, you know, beautiful, look at that. Or look at a sunset. You can't look at a sunset without something within you, because you're human, because you're made in God's image, saying, oh, that's beautiful. My, that's beautiful. The other day we were traveling along and saw the sun setting. It was through the haze, and it had filtered out all the destructive rays, and you could sit there and look at that great big orange ball of fire. And I just thought, my, how beautiful. But you know what? A mule sees that same thing. You don't see him sitting there on his tail saying, boy, that's beautiful. You don't even see him standing up on his feet saying that. He has no concept of the beauty of the universe. He sees the same stars. He sees the same sun. He sees everything. But you don't find him getting all upset and all up in the air about it. It just doesn't really mean much to him. But it does to you, because you're a human being. Now, I want to ask you a question. If in the matters of function, and if in the matters of beauty or aesthetics, if there is something in you that says, you know, that's right, may I ask you, what is it that drives you to the opposite conclusion about things that are moral? I maintain that if a man can evaluate motion and design and say, you know, that's right, if he can evaluate aesthetic beauty, things that appeal to the aesthetic values of our being, if we as human beings say that's right, I maintain that there's something in us also that whenever we view something that's morally right, that says, you know, that's right. That's right. But you know what the difference is? In the matter of aesthetics and in the matter of whatever it may be, aerodynamics, these things do not involve your will. And the reason why the world has gone crazy because of and gone into this moral depravity therein is because that when God talks about things that are right and wrong, the will of man has become involved, and man is not going to surrender what he thinks is his freedom. And so we say, no, I'm not going to live like that. It doesn't do anything to a man to refuse to fly in a plane. Let him refuse to fly. What difference does it make? But when a generation of people come to the moral laws of God and say that it is neither right nor wrong to steal, it is neither right nor wrong to commit adultery, it is neither right nor wrong to kill, it is neither right nor wrong to do all these other things that God has specifically said, this is wrong. And you can't do it. Because of that thing of sin in every one of us, in the sin in the world, or this thing of rebellion against God, we say, well, you're not going to tell me what to do. And the very devil that tempted Satan and said to her, you know, he's not really right on that. You're not going to die. Look at there. Isn't that beautiful? Look at it. It's good to look at. It's good for fruit, and it's for making your eyes open. You'll know the difference between right and wrong. You'll be like a god yourself. And we've taken it hook, line, and sinker. Well, the conclusion that I want to draw today is that simply that the sin of the world is the result of out-and-out rebellion. That they know God and they know His will. But because of our wills being involved and getting in the way, we refuse to let God have His place and His law, their place in our lives. And I don't care whether it's man's general inhumanity to man that causes us to rape and rob and steal and destroy each other, or whether it's man's inhumanity to womankind that causes them to abuse women, or whether it's the women's lib movement that causes the women then to rebel against the man, or whether it's the bisexual or unisexual drive that's going on today trying to get us to not know who we are, or whether it's some man having the hair of a woman on his head and debasing himself when nature itself teaches that it's a shame for a man to have that kind of hair, or whether it's this principle that simply says, the denial of it, that simply says we can live together whether we're married or not, doesn't make any difference. I don't care what it is. Every last bit of it, I maintain, is the result of rebellion against God. Children rebelling against the parents. Wives rebelling against the husbands. Husbands rebelling against God's law concerning the wife. Everybody's rebelling against God regarding the rights of other people. I think it's all rebellion, and I want to make a statement that you may take exception to and take me to task for, but I maintain that the world that is engaged in this kind of activity today, they do it knowing full well that they are in rebellion against God. I maintain that that is the condition of the world today, and that the world stands condemned. They stand in the condition of sin because of the fact that they do it, and do it knowing that it's wrong. Well, now, what difference does it make? Simply this, that the world today, because of the laws that God has placed within the universe, whether it be, it doesn't matter what it relates to, but the laws of morality that God has placed within the universe today, that were understood by the Gentile nations before the giving of the law, that were reinforced by God to the Hebrew nation when He gave the law of Moses, that all of this together just simply says that these things are something that everybody and his dog ought to know about. And for you to live in direct contradiction to it simply means that you're doing it out of just sheer rebellion against God. And that's sin. And that's what we're talking about. And that's what Christianity is all about. Next Sunday, we're going to notice a step further in the development of morality. Let me close because the time is up. The law leaves you. That's where it leaves you. It leaves you sitting in the middle of sin. That's all law can do. Because nobody can live up to it perfectly. That's where it leaves us sitting. But that's not good enough for the development of morality. You're going to have something better than that going for you if you're going to live a moral life. And we'll talk about that the next two Sundays. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we urge you to come. If your conviction of sin is sufficient, that you know what you want to do about it, know what God wants you to do about it, you want to get out of it, we encourage you. The whole plan of salvation is designed for this thing of sin being in mind. If you come in faith to God today, faith in Christ, if you come in repentance, that's turning you back upon sin. And if you'll come and be buried with Him in baptism, He'll forgive you of those sins through your response in faith. That's what it's all about. We're thankful for the Savior that He's made this privilege, made this opportunity for us. Would you come while we stand and sing?
More.